This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Doucet Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
Support for The Exchange Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. In the news this week, a subject that used to dominate New Hampshire headlines, state funding for public schools. The debate quieted down a few years ago with a new cap on state aid, but now some districts are feeling the squeeze. Those with growing enrollment, more students who are English language learners or qualify for school lunch subsidies. Republican House lawmaker David Bates of fast-growing Windham says the cap has got to go.
Because the current law caps any increases to 108% of what you received in the previous fiscal year. That's clearly unfair. It's arguably unconstitutional, and it's just plain wrong.
Also this week, more presidential politics with our primary about a year away. Politicians flirting with running are becoming familiar visitors to New Hampshire. This week, former New York Governor George Pataki stopped by NHPR, sounding a lot like a candidate.
I know I can lead a large, complex government, and not just lead it, but change it in the way to reduce its power and its impact and its influence and its cost in a way that I believe America needs right now.
Meanwhile, another study of commuter rail for the so-called Capital Corridor leaves out the capital, suggesting instead that a line from Boston to Manchester is more cost-effective. New Hampshire Rail Transit Authority Chairman Michael Izbicki explains.
The Manchester Regional Commuter Rail alternative would draw an average of 668,000 weekday riders a year.
But for many New Englanders, the Patriots Super Bowl victory topped all headlines. Here's Justin Koonin celebrating at a parade on Wednesday.
Yeah, I'm pretty damn happy.
Is that right?
Yeah, because we waited 10 years to win again. And that's how much it means to the people. That's how much it means to the fans.
It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange. Let's hear from you as we cover these and many other stories. Call in The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests with us for the hour. Gary Reno's here, State House reporter for the Union Leader in New Hampshire Sunday News. Hi, Gary.
Hello, Laura. Good to be here.
Also with us, Kathleen Ronay, New Hampshire State House and politics reporter for the Associated Press. Kathleen, thanks for taking time out.
Happy to be here.
And also with us, Dean Spiliotis, civics scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, good to see you as always.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, I want to start off very quickly with you, Gary, on a story that just broke yesterday, the day before, on the information of almost 300,000 Anthem customers here in the Granite State being potentially exposed in a security breach. Now, this is still developing, Gary. What do we know? What do we not know?
Well, what we do know is they say that they didn't get the medical information of people or credit card information. However, that's the good news. The bad news is they have your name, your address, your social security number, and everything else that they need to basically steal your identification.
Well, and once you have your all that much information, yeah, you can probably find the other information, right, Gary?
Oh, easily, very easily. And I mean, what's so important here in New Hampshire is that Anthem is just has such a huge percentage of the people in their healthcare system.
Creepy story, Dean Spiliotis.
Absolutely. As Gary said, don't worry. They didn't get your health information, just enough information to steal your identity. This is a bigger problem beyond New Hampshire. I think it's four or five states, 80 million people potentially affected.
Wow.
It seems like this is going to be kind of the next wave of cyber hacking. We had the issues with some of the big retailers like Target and Home Depot and others. Now they moved on to sort of more personal information. Other insurers, I think, are probably going to be checking their systems very carefully. But, you know, for better or worse, medical records are a huge part of life now, electronic medical records. Increasingly, our lives are lived on online, and the reality is there are going to be these kinds of hacks. It seems like the individuals who do this kind of stuff technologically are kind of one step ahead of a lot of these firms and companies that get kind of complacent. So, you know, I increasingly proceed on the assumption that pretty much everything about you is out there somewhere and can be found by a person who has the right technical skill at this point.
Well, again, this is still developing. So it's a story we'll be following here at NHPR as more information comes out. I also want to talk to all of you about the issue of education funding. And wow, Gary, this feels like back to the future. I mean, we spent so much time over the past two decades talking about this story. Just get us up to speed real quick. This issue's been quiet for a while.
It has. But I mean, it used to be the third rail of New Hampshire politics, but it's sort of calmed down a little bit. Over the years, we've had three formula changes since it was instituted about 20 years ago. The last one basically said if you get what you got in 2011 for your state aid, you will get in perpetuity. And as a way of dealing with that, they capped the amount of money that would a community could get year to year to initially 105.5% and then a couple of years ago to 108%. And what happened, particularly in communities along the southern tier of New Hampshire and in Dover particularly, the number of students and the number of kids on English as a second language and the number of kids on free and reduced lunch for the poor children grew a lot more than 8%. And so a lot of these communities aren't getting what they actually should under the formula. So David Bates, who's one of the reps from Wyndham, and several others are proposing that they change not the formula but the way the money's distributed and do away with some of the towns that have continued to get the same amount of money even though the number of students, et cetera, have gone down.
Yeah, that's the so-called stabilization grants, which we'll talk about in a minute. I also want to invite our listeners again to join us, 1-800-892-6477, email exchange@nhpr.org. Join us on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. And first up is Michael in Rockingham. Hi, Michael. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. This is Representative Michael Cahill representing Newmarket and Newfield.
Okay. Good morning.
School building aid is a particularly important interest to people in my district and many towns throughout the state. And when I look at the amount that we are overpaying with this misallocation of the school building education funding, this could fix the school building aid problem. It could fix more potholes. It could return money to cities and towns to help with their retirement for their civil servants. Just pick your priority. We could be doing better things with that money. So I'm hoping that people will look beyond the immediate short-term needs of their districts and support this measure and others to sort of reclaim, not only stop the overpaying, but gradually scale it back.
Well, Michael, let me ask you this, since you're serving in the legislature, so thank you for calling in. Is this a rare bipartisan issue?
I think it is, because everybody has schools and everybody has a view of what should be done with funding, and you know, it depends on whose ox is getting gored. I co-sponsored a bill with Representative Mullen because people in his town have had to build an elementary school, and with the moratorium, they have to foot the bill by themselves. State building aid, you know, is not there.
What about the so-called spreadsheet wars, Michael, where every time there's a change or a proposed change to education funding laws, the spreadsheet comes out and all the towns look at it and they see, you know, who wins and who loses?
Right. Well, there are going to be winners and losers short term. But if you lose some of the money that you really shouldn't be getting, then I think in the interest of fairness, you should manage to look at this differently. And perhaps you're going to need a school someday, or perhaps your firemen and teachers and policemen have contracts that are coming up, and maybe your property taxpayers don't want to pay for all of that. Like the state used to help with that, and then we stopped. We're downshifting everything we can because we don't want to raise a tax. We don't want to create a new tax, and yet we're misallocating this money.
Okay. Well, Michael, thank you for calling in. Kathleen, I'd love your thoughts here.
Yeah, I think, you know, school building aid is, I think, an important part of the calculation. There are, you know, districts have been fighting for this for several years now. They want to build additions to their schools, new schools. They want to update their schools that aren't passing safety codes. So that's another calculation in how much money should schools be getting. But I think that, you know, looking at the state's demographic trends, this is going to be an issue that we're going to have to keep, or lawmakers are going to have to keep talking about and grappling with. There are districts like Windham that are growing very rapidly, but overall, you know, we're not seeing as many children in our schools across the state. So what's happening is schools are getting that, you know, some schools, as Gary mentioned, that their populations are going down. They're still getting the same amount of money, because that would be a hit to lose money that they've been used to getting. But I think there are going to be questions about, is that per student basis the best way to be funding education? You know, again, what kind of obligation does the state have? And also, I mean, there are going to be so many other issues as our school age population continues to decline, schools consolidating, you know, laying
We've
off
seen
teachers,
that in Concord, right?
Et cetera. So
it's yeah.
I don't think it's just about, you know, this per pupil education funding. I think it has to be a larger conversation about our demographic trends and what kind of future are we looking for our school children, and how do we pay for that?
Yeah, it's a good point. And, you know, Dean, people hear about the stabilization grants for schools whose population has remained stable or gone down. And they think, well, yeah, gee, you know, fewer kids, they should get less money. But there's a certain threshold where it really gets troublesome, right, Dean? I mean, if there's 5 fewer kids or 10 fewer kids, that doesn't mean all of a sudden you can fire the assistant principal and the janitor and get rid of a teacher.
Right. No, it's a you know, we've been talking about this for many years now. It's a very difficult balancing act. You have real inequities across school districts in terms of the kind of resources that are available, you know, based on property tax. Generally, as we've been talking about, enrollments are declining overall, but there are some areas that are still growing. So you have to address that as well. But it is true that, school districts, you know, develop their budgets based on assumptions about how much money they had, and typically you want to either stay flat or increase. And if you start taking money away based on declining enrollments or other inequities, it just makes it really complicated to work out the puzzle, basically.
And sometimes, and speaking of the puzzle, Dean, and Gary, I'll turn to you. I mean, sometimes the numbers go down enough where they do get rid of a teacher.
Right.
But then maybe you have 30 kids in each class,
right.
And that's troublesome too.
And it's a balancing act. And, you know, when you start changing this formula, as we've done here 3 times, I mean, you're opening up a Pandora's box.
Is that it? Just 3 times?
Just 3 times. But the last time, I mean, it's been fairly stable. I mean, we had a public hearing yesterday on a proposal for a constitutional amendment, which basically would give the legislature more control over education. And very few people showed up.
Well, yeah, go ahead, Kathleen.
Yeah, I guess just one more thing, kind of looking at education funding and education as a whole. You know, there are, in addition to maybe building aid or wanting to do additions, I mean, there are schools, as they want new technologies, as they have to implement new testing, are there added costs with that? And,
right.
You know, what are the new costs for that? And I think that it's just this whole big issue that I think should be looked at holistically and not just how much money does each kid deserve.
Yeah, because as Common Core comes in, Kathleen, that's a computer-based test. So
yeah,
that's the issue right there. All right, well, coming up, another big topic at the State House, whether state police should wear body cameras. Chime in on that. We'd love to hear from you. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. And in a moment, we'll talk presidential politics. Former New York Governor George Pataki visits New Hampshire. We wonder why. Also, why a new commuter rail study leaves out the capital city of Concord. We'll talk about all those stories and more in just a moment. You can join us, too, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Join us on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. But first, all of you, and Kathleen, you first, I did want to turn to another real interesting story at the State House this week, a bill requiring state police wearing body cameras when interacting with the public. Where does this idea come from, Kathleen?
Yeah, so the prime sponsor on the bill, well, there's 2 bills, but the prime sponsor on one of the bills is Kyle Tasker. He's from Nottingham, and he's actually introduced this bill before, so I think he introduced it in the last session. So it's not necessarily in response to some of the issues about, you know, police incidents that we've been seeing, Ferguson and some in New York City. But I think that it, because of those issues, it kind of gives this bill a little bit more urgency. So when you talk to, you know, Representative Tasker, he says he's bringing it forward because it can, you know, protect the public, because if police know, you know, it hopefully would weed out police abuse if you know you're on camera. But protect police officers as well. If people are accusing them of, you know, poor conduct or, you know, treating them unfairly, or if there is, you know, we have had some fatal police shootings in New Hampshire. So having those cameras is a way to make sure that we get the story straight and, you know, there's some kind of record so it doesn't just turn into a he said, she said battle. You know, it's something that it's a complicated debate. I think, you know, one, there's the issue of cost. This is predicted, I think if it's just for state police, it's predicted to be about like $470,000 just to buy all of these cameras. So where does that money come from? There is a proposal on the table that would raise fees for civil and criminal cases. So you have to pay a little bit more and use some of that money to provide for the body cameras. But costs are an issue. What kind of cameras? You know, do you wear them on the chest? Do you wear them on the helmet? You know, the added costs over time of updating the software. You have to think about if these cameras are available, are more people going to be coming into the police stations and filing right to know requests and asking to see them? And what kind of, you know, personnel cost does that add? So they're really serious issues, but you know, there seems to be definitely some interest from both sides of the aisle. We've got, you know, Tasker, who's a Republican, and Rennie Cushing on the other side, who's a Democrat, that they're both really interested in this. So you know, whether or not it's something that can get through, we'll see. I think cost is going to be the biggest.
Yeah, but you're right. There is a lot of interest in this, given what we've seen now. Even though Representative Tasker, as you said, Kathleen, brought this bill up before. Kathleen's right. It's complicated. What are the complications do you see, Dean Spiliotis?
Well, the two big ones, obviously, as Kathleen mentioned, are cost and privacy. And, you know, when you're operating at the state level, talking about state police, I think there are a little over 400 state police. You know, we might be able to come up with the funds for that. But this is something that has been discussed at the local level for a number of years now. And you're talking about $300 per camera. The problem has been how do these local police departments fund these cameras. So that's the first complication. The second is the privacy issue. You know, when are there times when police are going to be required to turn these things off, like when maybe they're interviewing someone after a sexual assault or when they enter someone's home? Are they going to be able to have them on, as Kathleen mentioned, people requesting right to know, you know, how will this be treated as evidence? It's a very thorny issue, and privacy advocates have been pretty vocal about it. But I think there is an increasing feeling that given some of the high-profile conflicts we've seen nationally where it becomes kind of the wildly differing accounts of what actually happened, it may be the way to go. But particularly at the local level, cost is a real problem.
Well, sure. And you can also imagine that, you know, some embarrassing footage, Dean, might go viral.
Sure, on YouTube,
and,
right.
You know,
you end up on YouTube, right.
Go ahead, Kathleen. Yeah, and then Gary, go ahead.
I think, you know, from the Department of Safety's perspective, I think there's also this idea that, you know, cameras are not a be-all, end-all solution. And even with, you know, a camera, a small camera, you still don't see everything. You don't know maybe some sounds or some off-camera sights that are happening that are affecting that police officer's decision. So is the camera going to give the appearance that, you know, we know exactly what happened and maybe we don't? So what kind of problems does that create? And I will say that there are some local departments across the state that have been using body cameras, the Ware Police Department, which, you know, as we all know, has had some of its own struggles, has been using body cameras. The state police are going to start a pilot program with body cameras. So I almost wonder if this is an issue that lawmakers might try and push off until next year if they want to see how the pilot program
goes. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, Gary,
well,
go ahead.
I mean, what we haven't said yet is that the state police are opposing this bill. They don't really say it's premature. And as Kathleen said, they were talking about a pilot program. And I think there'll be a lot of push from the state police and the Department of Safety to put this off, put it into study. Let us see what the pilot program does. They've had for years the dashboard cameras in the cruisers, but only in about a third of them. And we had an attorney come in and testify, a DWI attorney from Concord, who said, "You won't believe the difference between what you can see with that dashboard camera and what the police report is." So, I mean, there's a lot of interest in here seeing that these go forward, but I think we're going to see it probably delayed at least a year.
Okay. Well, again, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in the exchange. Join us as we talk about some of the big stories around the state this week, including the question of whether state police should wear body cameras, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. I want to turn to another big story that came out earlier this week, all of you, and that's commuter rail. There have been a lot of studies of commuter rail. Kathleen Ronayne, who is behind this latest one? How is it different from past studies?
So the New Hampshire Rail Transit Authority did this study, and it was a federally funded study. So New Hampshire did not have to put any money down for this study. And what it did is it looked at, you know, not just the costs of a program like this, but the average rider, who's going to be riding it, what kind of economic development it would bring to the state. So a lot of interesting numbers in that report. Of course, we have people who are opposed to rail that are kind of questioning a lot of the numbers in there. So I don't know that, you know, another study with new numbers is really going to be the solution that is going to make people say we need to do this, because there's someone who's always going to dispute the numbers that are in there.
Well, we've got some Facebook comments from our listeners, many of whom who like it and many of whom who say no way. Before I read these, though, Dean, I did want to ask you, it's kind of interesting that this is called the Capital Corridor Project, but the Capital was left out.
Right. That's right. And the study really suggests going from Lowell to Nashua and Manchester, and, you know, Concord is sort of on the table, but not really. It was very funny. If you read the story in the Concord Monitor, it was almost as though the folks didn't want to let down Concord, that it probably not going to go to Concord, just that it's not worth the additional cost, and it doesn't create the kind of jobs they're talking about down in Manchester and Nashua.
Gary, go ahead.
Well, the reason that you don't see Concord in there really is if you look at what the subsidy would be for the ridership from Nashua and Manchester, it's about $10 per person. And if it's from Concord, it's about $61 per person.
Oh, wow. That's a big jump.
So it's a huge jump if you're talking about the subsidy and what the state costs would be year to year, not just the capital cost. When you think the state capital budget, which is a two-year budget, usually is about $120 to $130 million every 2 years. This is talking about at least $70 million of state money that would have to go there. That's like half the capital budget.
And so, yet Governor Hassan, in her inaugural address, said she loves this idea.
She does.
Well, let me share a couple comments from our Facebook page. And again, if you want to chime in on this topic, we'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Here's Max, who says, the question we asked, by the way, was, would you use a commuter rail that runs through Manchester and Nashua to Boston? That's the question we put out to people. Max says, most definitely, it's a fantastic idea. I live in Jaffrey, and I'd love to just be able to drive to Nashua, take the train to the city. Jamie says, definitely, I live in Manchester. This would be very convenient. Chip says, I would. Driving into Boston is a nightmare. Kaith says, if they can put a leg going to the Manchester airport, it would give folks another alternative for transportation into Boston. Pete says he wants to see a seacoast to Manchester route would be great. He says it seems to be enough commuters on 101 each morning to justify it. Grant says no, but if it ran up to Concord or Hanover, Lebanon, I would. Brian says, hell yes. I just got back from Europe. Rail travel is a super way to go. Here's Bill, though. He says, both the UL page and Charlie Arlinghouse's columns have complained vociferously about the fact that the New Hampshire Advantage has gone down the tubes. New Hampshire is no longer attractive to businesses and people. They complain about how younger people are no longer moving here. Bill says improvements in infrastructure, including rail, is one of the answers to this problem. He says without these improvements, New Hampshire will be left in the dust. And finally, here's Neil, who says, you're kidding me, right? He says commuter rail in mass is never on time, only goes to North Station. Cost to implement far outweighs the benefit. You're naive if you think companies will come in droves across the border when doing business in New Hampshire is far more expensive than in mass. He says Boston Express has excellent bus service. Why not expand that service to more areas at a far lower cost? He calls it a pipe dream that will never get off the ground. Just real quickly, Gary, the bus service is there from Concord and right. Nashua and Londonderry and Manchester.
Right.
What about that? That's often offered as the alternative to rail.
It is, and it's been very successful, actually. Both corridors, the Nashua to Boston and the Manchester to Boston. The Nashua to Boston one is making money. The one from Nashua, from Manchester to Boston, it still is being somewhat subsidized by the state and the federal government. But they certainly have been drawing a lot of people, and they've been very successful so far.
And I wonder if the bus companies, sometimes they've let it be known politically that they're not in love with rail because that would take away business
from them. One of the owners of Concord coach and Boston Express is Jim Jalbert from Dover area. And he really is not a fan of rail and has gone around and made sure that people know that it's going to be very costly and it's nowhere near as efficient as his bus services.
Again, our phone number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Kathleen, quick thought from you there.
Yeah, I think something that we keep coming back to here, whether it's rail or body cameras or education funding, is, I mean, the bottom line is always about the cost for everything. And I think we've seen in New Hampshire this year already, you know, where some departments are having a tough time meeting their budgets. There's always questions about what we need to cut if we don't want to raise revenue. So I think that, you know, there are a lot of different ideas out there, and people can argue philosophically about the ideas, but there are definitely, I mean, the cost is the bottom line. And we're seeing with this study even, you know, the more conservative-leaning Josiah Bartlett Center, where Charlie Arlinghouse works, they're coming out and saying this study, it's not accurately reflecting how much money would come in from rider fees, and we're not correctly estimating what the true cost of this is going to be. And I think, you know, it's with every issue and, you know, you can say it's fortunate or unfortunate, depending on your views. We have to keep coming back to how's New Hampshire state government going to pay for this? And if we want to pay for it, do we need, you know, to raise taxes? Do we need to cut elsewhere? And where do we cut? And that's kind of always the question with all of these big ideas.
Well, and a really relevant point, Kathleen, given that the governor presents her budget on Thursday, right? So
yeah, exactly. And we'll see, you know, what does she want to include money for some of these ideas that she's supporting and talking about.
Dean?
Yeah, no, Kathleen mentioned philosophical differences, and I've been fascinated as I watch these kinds of proposals in cities around the country, the extent to which rail has become ideologically polarizing. Mm-hmm. It breaks down often very – support of it often breaks down very neatly along Republican and Democratic lines. You know, Republicans see it as big government subsidy. It's not a moneymaker. It takes money away from resources that could go to improving roads, which gives people the liberty to drive their cars when they want to drive them. So it has this real sort of, you know, sort of ideological flavor about a denial of liberty and a funneling of tax money into these what they call boondoggles rather than economically improving projects. So mm-hmm. I think you're going to see the proponents of this make a heavy, strong case about jobs and the economy, because it's going to be an argument that this is not going to be viable, and it's going to be a lot of money.
And for a very practical matter here in the state of New Hampshire, I mean, Senate President Chuck Morris is very much opposed to this. And in chance of getting any kind of money for this in the next 2 years is almost nil.
All right. Well, we'll close it out at that. But I think this is an issue we're going to have to look at in more detail on the roundup and perhaps in a future show. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email us exchange@nhpr.org. Kathleen, I did want to ask you about a bill that got a lot of attention in the legislature. With the nation focused on immunizations, vaccines, and some scary measles cases around the country, it's come to light that New Hampshire is the only state not to have a vaccine registry right now. Just before we talk about New Hampshire's registry, what are these, Kathleen? How are they used in other states?
Yeah, so the vaccine registries, they're used for several purposes. You know, one, they're a way for, I think, doctors, you know, to be aware of if they're getting new patients or different patients in and want to check records, you know, who has these vaccines. Obviously, doctors keep their own records, but I think having the registry there makes it a little bit easier to cross-check things. They can also be used if there is a public outbreak of, say, measles, for someone to be able to check the registry and reach out to all of the families with kids or people that are not vaccinated and say, you might want to go out and get a vaccination. There's an outbreak of this. So I think it's a way to maybe have a mechanism there that can help you attempt to contain an outbreak and to notify people if an outbreak is occurring. You know, every other state has one of these. New Hampshire doesn't. We do have one of the highest child vaccination rates in the country. About, according to the CDC, about 95% of school-age children in New Hampshire are vaccinated. So it's not really a question about should or shouldn't people be vaccinated, but rather how are we tracking this? And it's, I think it's been a little hard to get it off the ground because there's this idea of who should opt in and who should opt out. It's kind of that personal privacy issue. So there's a bill going through right now that is discussing that, exactly, you know, what the opt-in and opt-out procedure is. And
opt-in and opt-out of whether your information
is in the registry.
There.
And if you do choose to opt out, should there be a list saying that you're one of the people who opted out? So that's kind of the question. And to what extent, you know, do people have that freedom to not have their information in the system? And again, you know, it's not a question about should we be vaccinating or not. It's about, you know, who's in this registry and how can you be not in the registry if you choose?
I'm guessing, though, Kathleen, as you cover this bill, that the whole national debate about this is coming into play.
I'm sure it will. I'm sure that it will. You know, as I said, New Hampshire does have one of the highest vaccination rates. So, you know, I mean, we'll see. I'm sure it will. I'm sure it will come up.
Go ahead, Gary. Yeah.
Well, unlike some larger states like California, New Hampshire has just two reasons to opt out of a vaccination. One is for a medical reason. Another is religious. We don't have a philosophical reason, which is what the problem is out in California, where you have all these people who are philosophically opposed to the idea. You don't get to do that in New Hampshire. So the issue is, are you going to be able to just opt out, or do you have to opt in? And that's the big privacy issue that's being debated right now in the legislature.
Well, from that to very quickly, Dean Spiliotis, presidential politics, and we'll pick up more after a break. But the Boston Globe's James Pindle summarized the New Hampshire primary this way. He said, suddenly New Hampshire's anybody's race with the departure of Mitt Romney. What do you think?
That's technically true. I always like to qualify it by saying that if there's a field of 8 or 10 candidates, there probably really are 3 or 4 who are the most likely for the nomination. I mean, there are a number of people who will get in and get a lot of coverage, but who really have no chance of being the nominee. So I would give a qualified yes to the wide open statement. I think this, you know, because Mitt Romney got out, I think that makes a big difference for sure. And that will sort of change how New Hampshire plays into the process probably. But, you know, we're still talking about the same, you know, fairly small number of big players, Jeb Bush and Rand Paul and Scott Walker, Chris Christie potentially, maybe Marco Rubio. There, I mean, I just named 4+. And there are others as well that we're going to see here who I just don't think are likely to be the nominee. But, yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun and there are going to be a lot of people coming and going.
Well, I've got a couple more names I want to ask all of you about in just a moment, including George Pataki, former governor of New York, who is here this week. Also, whether there will be any women on that list that you mentioned, Dean. So we'll talk about that after a break. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. We'll also follow the alarming story of a rise in substance abuse deaths in the Granite State. We'll hear more about that, too. After a break, this is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and we'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Gary Reno, Kathleen Ronayne, Dean Spiliotis, I want to turn now to a story that we've been following The Exchange for some time now. That's an alarming rise in substance abuse deaths in New Hampshire, overdose deaths. With us now is Kathy Marchocki with the Telegraph of Nashua. She's been covering this story. Kathy, thanks for your time.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you had a report this week, Kathy, with some new numbers on drug overdose deaths, and it doesn't look good. What about 2014? What do we know?
Well, you're right. It does not look good. The numbers so far today, confirmed drug overdose deaths, are 284. And this compares to 193 from last year, the year prior to 2013. 2012, we had 170, but it was it beats the prior record of 205 drug overdose deaths that were recorded in 2011. So it's a very new and stunning record that's being hit in New Hampshire.
Wow, that's a lot more. Yeah, go ahead, Kathy.
It is a lot more, and the numbers aren't completely in. These are confirmed to date. The chief medical examiner's office still has some cases that are pending final causes of death, so that number could still go up.
You also wrote, Kathy, in your story that there's a new drug that seems to be contributing to this rise. Tell us more about that.
Yes. In late 2013, I'm sure, you know, Laura, you've been doing an awful lot on this. I'm sure you recall there was the presence of fentanyl-laced heroin that was making its appearance in some of the mid-Atlantic states and moving up the coast towards New England. The first appearance of that fentanyl-laced heroin in New Hampshire was confirmed in late December 2013 when a Manchester man died from an overdose of it. And then Dr. Thomas Andrew, who is the chief medical examiner, said that through the spring of last year, you know, late winter, spring, they noticed more of these fentanyl heroin mixes, but then it became straight fentanyl deaths. And soon, fentanyl deaths or fentanyl combined with either heroin or maybe cocaine were starting to outstrip heroin alone as the cause of death, which is an extremely, you know, I think most people would agree that that's a very troubling trend.
Well, how much more powerful is fentanyl, Kathy, than other drugs that people overdose on, such as heroin?
Fentanyl is, it's in its most, you know, traditionally known, fentanyl is known as a synthetic narcotic painkiller. And it is used in the pharmaceutical grades, used as an injection or used as lozenges or patches for pain killing, for end-of-life care. It is considered multiple times more potent than morphine. I hate to cite a specific number because I've heard law enforcement and doctors use such a broad range, but the type of fentanyl that we're speaking of here is manufactured in these little clandestine laboratories. As Dr. Andrew said, many of them are made in little mobile lab units in Mexico, and then they're packaged to look just like heroin and sold on the streets. The DEA cites that that type of fentanyl can be hundreds of times more potent than heroin.
And are people getting mixed up, Kathy? Yeah. Do we know, like, they think they're taking something a little less powerful, and then it ends up being fentanyl and it kills them?
Absolutely. That is the key. There's no quality control in the production of this fentanyl. It's packaged just like heroin, so the supplier of this drug may not know that what he's selling his user is fentanyl and not heroin, and the user may not know that this is fentanyl, may think it's heroin, or may not be aware that there is a presence of fentanyl in with this heroin.
Wow.
So the part of the things that would go on with the body is that it's much more addictive, and it's much more likely, even very small amounts, can cause, you know, the decline in breathing and death.
Wow. So as if heroin weren't bad enough, right? So what's been the reaction, Kathy, among state officials, local police, local emergency responders who are really dealing with this?
Well, for local, I'll start with the last. The local emergency responders are citing numerous more instances where they're responding to 911 calls to administer the anti-narcotic, I think they call it a narcotic antagonist. Basically, we most commonly know it by the trade name of Narcan.
Right.
And emergency medical technicians and some firefighters trained, and I think now police who are trained in it, can administer this drug, which we basically neutralizes the effects of the opioid in the body if you catch it in time. Some people live, some people don't. But they have shown that, for instance, in Nashua, 911 calls for Narcan from 2013 were 117. 2014, they rose to 152. In Manchester, and this, these are the American emergency response ambulance crews that provide the private ambulances to both those cities. In Manchester, in the same year period, there were 206 911 calls for Narcan. In 2013, that number rose to 391 in 2014.
Oh, so those numbers show us some really big increases, Kathy.
It's also showing that in most, I think, law enforcement, and I think also people in the chief medical examiner's office would say undoubtedly there would be more overdose deaths if it had not been for Narcan. They don't save everybody, but they have saved quite a few people. And one thing in Nashua, Deputy Chief Michael Carignan, who has a handle on a lot of this issue, he mentioned that when they took out four mid- to high-level street-level traffickers last year, they noticed the demand for Narcan just plummeted almost immediately afterwards. So they can see that there's an effect there.
Well, Kathy, go ahead.
Well, just in terms of other efforts, as you know, there's the effort to have a bill to ban synthetic drugs, and I think the drug court effort is, many law enforcers will say that's a remarkable step in a right direction to try to deal with this issue.
Kathy, thank you very much. A sobering story. We really appreciate you being with us.
Oh, my pleasure, and you take care.
That's Kathy Marchocki, again, reporter for the Telegraph of Nashua, following the story of an alarming rise in substance abuse overdose deaths. All of you, I want to turn back to our conversation about the presidential primary heating up here in New Hampshire. And Dean Spiliotis, you gave a list of some leading contenders. Didn't notice any women on that list.
Well, yeah, and it's sort of my sense of who's likely to be most competitive for the nomination. It is true that Carly Fiorina, former CEO of Hewlett-Packard, has expressed interest in running. She ran unsuccessfully for U.S. Senate in California in 2010, I believe. Potential to be well-funded. I'm actually talking to her on Tuesday, so I'll get a better sense of what her intentions are then. But she's certainly part of the conversation. She has started a leadership pack geared at getting more women interested in Republican Party politics. That's been one of her goals. So she could potentially be a player. She's been a commentator and an analyst for some time now. So people are probably reasonably familiar with her. Just a quick process note. It's been fascinating to me to watch the extent to which the exploratory committee is no longer the sort of the primary means for getting into the race. It's now these leadership packs. So when I hear somebody is exploring a race, they're not forming an exploratory committee. They're setting up their leadership pack because it gives them more versatility in terms of raising money, in terms of engaging the policy debate that's going on. And we mentioned George Pataki. We can talk about the former New York governor. He set up a PAC and was involved in congressional races in 2012. He now has a PAC to help him explore a presidential race as well.
So, and we're talking on the Republican side. We haven't talked about the Democrats
yet. Because
there's been so much activity on the Republican
side.
Right. Go ahead, Kathleen. Who have you seen, heard? Who's coming to the state?
Yeah, so we're starting, you know, before the November election, we saw a lot of candidates coming under the guise of, you know, helping, trying to elect other people. We saw Chris Christie come here 5 times for Walt Havenstein.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah, it was. But then there's been a little bit of a lull as, you know, for some of these governors that are considering running, you know, their state legislatures are kicking back into session. People take a break over the holidays. But starting next week, we're going to see it really start ramping up again. Carly Fiorina is going to be here. Rick Perry is going to be here. Chris Christie's coming on February 16th. He's speaking in Concord. And that'll be his first trip back since he was here, you know, helping someone else. Now he's here for himself. And, you know, I think in March I've seen reports that Marco Rubio is going to be here. Ted Cruz is going to be here. Scott Walker is going to be here. In April, the New Hampshire Republican Party is going to be doing this big conference, similar to what they did last year, obviously, but we weren't as far into the presidential season. We don't have a list for that yet, but I expect we're going to see a lot of people. So everyone's kind of in that phase of exploring whether they want to get in or not. And what's just kind of a side note, what's been so interesting to me is that no one's declared, yet we're already talking about people as if they're like in or dropping out. Like the phrase we keep using for Mitt Romney is, oh, Mitt Romney dropped out of the race.
He was never officially in.
He was never in the race. He just said, I might do it. And I know why we're saying dropping out. I think I'm not saying it's anyone's wrong to say it. It's just so interesting that we're a year away and no one's declared, but it's already like we have this rough race going on.
Part of that is just how the media narrative works. And part of it is that we've all been doing this long enough that you sort of know the level of intentionality necessary for someone to be checking out a presidential run, whether or not they have a PAC, whether or not they have an exploratory committee. So I think we use that shorthand, but it's based on kind of real behavior by these individuals.
Yeah. Well, and a year isn't that far away.
No, I mean, it really isn't. It isn't.
If you're going to run a presidential campaign.
If you're going to put people on the ground and get your ground troops in order, and you're going to go out and start trying to meet people and get around and put your name out there in a big way, I mean, you got to be starting now. And if you're not starting now, you're going to be behind the eight ball come this summer.
Yeah. Well, and Dean, last question for you on this. And we talked with Ken Rudin about this earlier this week, but I'd like your thoughts, too.
Sure.
So lots of activity on the Republican side, as we've said, a list too long almost to count, really. So many names, as Kathleen and you mentioned. What about the Democrats? Pretty quiet.
It's very quiet. You know, I think the reality is this is Hillary Clinton's nomination if she wants it. We've, in fact, heard from people around her that she may push back announcing into the summer because there's no rush and, you know, why you potentially get yourself into trouble before you're really ready. You know, there have been a couple of other vocal players. Bernie Sanders was here recently, gave a talk in Concord at Arne Arneson's house. It was a good turnout. Elizabeth Warren, there's a draft Elizabeth Warren group that is spending significant money to try to entice her into the race. You know, I think the reality is both of those individuals could have an impact on kind of the discourse if they were to run, and they may kind of put Hillary Clinton into interesting and uncomfortable positions in terms of things like her relationship with Wall Street. And they have, you know, interesting ideas that should be debated among Democrats. But in terms of kind of the process of getting the nomination, there's no one who can compete with her in terms of organization and fundraising and just sort of general momentum. Joe Biden, you know, my guess is he probably won't run, even though he doesn't want to be put in the position of actually saying that. So there's just not a lot going on. The excitement is clearly on the Republican side right now.
Kathleen.
Yeah, one name Dean didn't mention, Martin O'Malley. He's going to be back here next month. He came, you know, he's come up several times. But
Democratic governor of Maryland.
Former Democratic governor of Maryland. Yeah. But, you know, I do think, and I know that it's different than 2008, but I think the Democrats have to be careful about the appearance of a Hillary Clinton coronation, because I think that there is a lot of excitement around her from, you know, members of the Democratic base, people in general. But I think that, you know, the general population that's maybe not paying attention, you know, I'm not saying it's going to be a nail in the coffin for her, but I think they need to be careful because I don't think that voters typically like this idea. I think I saw a quote from, Jim Messina, an Obama advisor, maybe last week, that said about Hillary, it's her turn. And those are the kind of things that Democrats should not be saying, because I don't think they're going to sit well.
That has been traditionally kind of the Republican mode of operating, is there's sort of a logical nominee. You know, Martin O'Malley, you know, he's got his work cut out for him. He's not going to be known outside of Maryland, probably almost no name recognition. Gave what I thought was a very weak speech at the Democratic convention in 2012. So, yeah, he's clearly exploring it, but, you know, he's probably in the weakest position out of the group of people we've discussed.
Well, completely switching gears from presidential politics. I can't even come up with a good segue to this next story. So, Gary, I'm just going to turn to you. The Manchester Monarchs. This is a hockey team in Manchester.
Right.
I'm not sure what level it is. It's not obviously the level of the Bruins, but it's
it's called American Hockey League, which is the level right below. If you were saying baseball, we'd talk about a triple A team.
There you go. The word I was searching for. And, you know, kids love this team, and people go to the Verizon Center, and they're popular. They're leaving for California. How come?
Well, there's a whole group of them. There are like five or six teams that are in the American Hockey League that are in this area in the Northeast, and they're all being moved to California because they're all the farm teams for these California National Hockey League teams. I mean, the simple fact of the matter is you're a day away. If you want to call up somebody at the Monarchs and you're the Los Angeles Kings, which is the parent company, I mean, you can't bring them there for that day, the game that night, because it takes them a day to get there. And so they're starting a league out in California, basically, of the minor league, the AAA, if you will, minor league teams for these hockey teams out in California. They're going to be replacing them with an Eastern League team, which we're going from like AAA to single A with the Eastern League.
And I'm not a sports person. That means less high
you won't
level.
Be – these people, you know, when you're watching the Monarchs – you're being able to watch some of the future stars of the National Hockey League.
Okay, that's exciting.
And that's exciting. We're not going to be watching the future stars of the National Hockey League.
What's that going to mean for the Verizon arena?
Well,
where
that remains to be seen. I mean, Verizon was built around basically the Monarchs coming there to play hockey, and they've done very well, and they still continue to draw pretty well. And it remains to be seen what happens.
And I think the Fisher Cats do well, and I believe they're a double A team, not
they're
a triple A.
Yeah.
So there's still excitement to have a sports team, and it's been a good market for people who like hockey.
Well, so one of my sons has a Monarchs shirt. Gary, should we sell it on eBay? What should we do?
Well, I'm guessing that they're going to probably name the Eastern League team the Monarchs.
They are the Monarchs. Okay. No, they are the new Monarchs. That's
all right,
already
that's
been
helpful.
Decided. Yeah, so just changing the kind of the caliber, not in terms of the actual marketing and the name.
Well, I did want to close out with a special shout-out to Jared Cassidy of Windham High School in Windham, New Hampshire, announced the recipient of the second annual Music Educator Award presented by the Recording Academy and the Grammy Foundation. So this is a big, big, big deal. In total, more than 7,000 initial nominations were submitted from all 50 states. The Music Educator Award, this is reading from a release here, says was established to recognize educators who've made a significant and lasting contribution to the field of music and who demonstrate a commitment to the broader cause of maintaining music education in the schools. So he'll get this award on Saturday during Grammy Week. It's a big deal for someone in the Granite State to win this national award. So I just wanted to recognize that. And next week, folks, I think we'll all be watching the governor's budget. She's supposedly going to present it on Thursday. So we'll probably be talking about that next week on the Roundup. I want to thank everybody for coming in. Kathleen, good to see you.
Thanks,
you for
Laura.
Being here. Kathleen Roney, New Hampshire State House and Politics reporter for the Associated Press. Gary, good to see you. We'll see you next
good
week,
soon.
I think.
Thanks.
All Bye-bye. Right. Gary Reynow, State House reporter for the Union Leader and New Hampshire Sunday News. Dean Spiliotis, thank you very much.
Sure thing. Thanks, Laura.
Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The producer is Faith Mikesell and Jason Moon. Our intern is Joanna Albertson-Grove. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.